This is part two of Near Death Experience. Welcome, my friends, to Jackson Snyder Presents from the Vero Essien Yahad in Vero Beach, Florida, a great new development in science. Near-death experiences have been studied seriously now for about 35 or 40 years. And it's getting to the point where medical doctors, philosophers, biologists, and even heart scientists are starting to come to grips with the possibility of everlasting life. The basic concept that's being explored is that the mind, intellect, experiences, and very being of a person is non-local. That means that these aspects of who you are may not be stored in what you are. That is, that what makes you you is thought to reside outside your body, perhaps in storage units called fields that are made up of space-time. Previously, the concept has been that if the brain is dead, because the brain stores experiences, feelings, and personality, then you are dead. But if these traits of the experience of being human reside non-locally, reside in a different place than your physical body, then what might be the case is that when death to the physical body comes, we experience merely a transition to a different sort of body. Now, this thinking is lining up very well with a number of our theological concepts. That is, what we have believed about life after death for literally 2,500 years. If scientists are beginning to think this way, then it won't be long before serious scientific research could lead us on a path to understanding our spirituality better, and certainly the life to come. What is changing minds? The fact that so many people have experienced the NDE, the near-death experience. And some people have experienced not only that, but the post-death experience. And that's what we'll look into in what is bound to become another series of lessons attempting to expose the truth behind the scriptural descriptions of a man or woman going on to visions and revelations and everlasting ageless life. Richard Bach gives us a test to find out whether our missions on Earth are finished or not. He says, if you're alive, your mission isn't finished. So we'll begin this second part of near-death experiences with a report that's typical of near-death experiences in general, and of the difficult process of coming to terms with the experiences afterwards. This particular NDE is precipitated by serious complications during the delivery of a child. So this is the NDE of a woman. I'm afraid I don't have a woman here to read it, so my voice will have to suffice. On September 23rd, 1978, I get my first contractions. At that point, I'm 9 months pregnant with, as we learn later, our second daughter. My entire pregnancy has been a textbook case. After some time, my husband and I join the midwife and go to the hospital. I'm wheeled into the delivery room. The midwife regularly listens to the child's heartbeat through the large wooden horn, that is, a natural stethoscope. The waters are broken. The delivery room becomes extremely quiet. People are rushing around and talking to one another in soft yet urgent voices. When I ask what's happening, neither I nor my husband receives a reply. The contractions stop, but I'm feeling fine. Meanwhile, the gynecologist has joined us along with some more nurses. We have no idea what's happening. I'm told to start pushing, but I have no contractions. This doesn't seem to matter. There's a rattling of tongs, scissors, trays, and tissues. My husband passes out and is pulled out of the delivery room and left in the corridor. Suddenly, I realize that I'm looking down at a woman lying on a bed with her legs in supports. I see the nurses and doctors panicking. I see a lot of blood on the bed and on the floor. I see large hands pressing down hard on the woman's belly, and then I see the woman giving birth to a child. The child is immediately taken to another room. The nurses look dejected. Everybody is waiting. My head is knocked back hard when the pillow is suddenly pulled away. Once again, I witness a great commotion. Swift as an arrow, I fly through a dark tunnel. I'm engulfed by an overwhelming feeling of peace and bliss. I feel intensely satisfied, happy, calm, and peaceful. I hear wonderful music. I see beautiful colors and gorgeous flowers in all colors of the rainbow in a large meadow. At the far end is a beautiful, clear, warm light. This is where I must go. I see a figure in a light garment. This figure is waiting for me and reaches out her hand. It feels like a warm and loving welcome. Hand in hand, we move toward the beautiful and warm light. Then she lets go of my hand and she turns around. I feel something pulling me back. I notice a nurse slapping me hard on my cheeks and calling my name. After some time, I realize where I am, and I know that my child isn't well. Our daughter is no longer alive. This return hurts so much. I long to go back to, indeed, where to? The world goes on turning. My NDE was caused by blood loss during the delivery. Initially, this blood loss went largely unnoticed by the nurses. Everybody must have been too focused on the birth of the child. They only intervened at the last moment by pulling the pillow from under my head, giving me blood, and I didn't see any more. By then, I'd reached the heavenly paradise. When I returned from this beautiful world, this amazing experience, my reception here in this world was cold, frosty, and above all, loveless. The nurse with whom I tried to share my beautiful experience dismissed it by saying that I would soon receive medication to help me sleep, and then it would all be over. All over? I didn't want that. I didn't want it to be all over at all. I wanted to go back. The gynecologist told me that I was still young and that I could have plenty more children. I should move on and look forward to the future. I stopped telling my story. It was difficult enough to find words for my experience because how could words express what I had experienced? But what else could I do? Who could I talk to? What was the matter with me? Had I gone crazy? The only person I could tell my story to over and over again was my husband. He listened and asked questions, even though he didn't understand what had happened to me, what this experience meant or what it was called, and whether I was the only person with such an experience. I was, and still am today, delighted that he was a good listener. My NDE didn't jeopardize our relationship, and I know now that this is very precious indeed. Speaking of unconditional love, but I did feel like I was the only person who had experienced such a thing. Nobody asked me anything. Nobody was interested. To be fair, my situation made it harder because how do you react when you expect a birth announcement and you receive a death notice instead? For many people, that's hard enough, even without having to listen to an experience like mine. During that time, I lived like an automaton. Although I looked after my husband and our eldest daughter and I walked the dog, my mind was elsewhere. My mind was on my experience. How could I reconnect with it? Where could I hear such beautiful music, see such lovely colors, find such gorgeous flowers, and see such a dazzling light, experiencing so much unconditional love? And was I crazy for thinking these things? What was the matter with me? In my undergraduate dissertation, I proposed the following key recommendations for healthcare practitioners. I would have been immensely grateful for only 1% of all the advice now found in books and articles on NDE. In 1978, support was clearly not of the same high standard as it is today. But apart from regular nurses, the gynecologist, and the midwife, I didn't see anybody. The family doctor never came to see me, not even after a couple of weeks. He never even got in touch with me. Did he assume I was doing okay? I didn't go and see him either. After all, what could I have told him? I'd come to the conclusion that my experience was abnormal and that it was better to keep silent. My checkups at the gynecologist revealed no irregularities. On a mechanical level, I was still functioning fine, and that was all that mattered. No further questions were asked, so I kept silent. I spent years dedicated to a silent search. When I finally found a book in the library that mentioned an NDE, I could scarcely imagine that I'd had such an experience. Surely not. I had stopped believing myself. Only very, very gradually did I find the courage and the strength to believe myself and to trust my experience, and to start accepting and integrating it into my life. It wasn't easy. Over the years, I had developed a fairly successful survival strategy, or rather flight strategy. I fled from my feelings, and I fled from myself. I'd taken on more and more work. I'd also thrown myself into sports, running of all things. How symbolic. I was running away from myself and from my NDE. Initially, this worked out well. Also, in the eyes of the world, I often found myself clutching flowers on the winner's podium. But these weren't the flowers I was looking for. I struggled to accept the opinions of others, of colleagues. My inner conflicts between what I knew and what I felt intensified. Everything became increasingly difficult. Then my body intervened. From being overworked and stressed, from what I felt was a burnout, I slipped into depression. I received treatment from a psychologist who worked in the homeopathic tradition. There's no such thing as coincidence. He was the first healthcare practitioner who listened to my story, to my experience. He believed it and even considered it normal. But this was more than 20 years after my NDE. He told me to sketch the experience or write it down, to actively engage with it. With his help, I made a fascinating journey into my inner self. Everything was accepted and considered normal. Now I realize that I'm not crazy, but that my NDE changed me. This is why my fear of death has disappeared completely, in marked contrast with the prior years to my NDE, years in which I struggled with death and with the fear of death. This is why I have difficulties with the concepts of time. These days, I constantly lose track of time, whereas before, I lived by the clock. Material things aren't important to me anymore. The only thing that matters to me is unconditional love. And this is what I've always had with my husband. Yet, recently, I read in a study that unconditional love between human beings is an illusion. And they refuse to believe me. This is why I feel like an outsider sometimes. This is why I'm always, especially during vacations, on the lookout for landscapes, for colors and flowers that I've seen but can't find again. This is why I can't stand arguments. I want to go back to those peaceful surroundings. As a matter of fact, I'm incapable of arguing. Having made my inner journey to where I am now, I'm glad that I had my NDE. I accept it as a beautiful experience, as something that gives me peace and allows me to be myself, a self that includes my experience. I can now enjoy life with my experience. Integrating my NDE can only make this world a better place. It was only when I began to accept and integrate my NDE that I was able to take some pleasure in life again. My thoughts and feelings are relevant after all. They are neither strange nor crazy. I need them to cut through the chaos, to carve out my own identity amid the masses. Of course, I still face the task of raising awareness of NDE among people, especially healthcare practitioners. Having carried out a small-scale study among the family doctors in my hometown, I was disappointed to learn that many of them still don't know what to do when somebody has an NDE. But the most important thing for me now is that I can be who I am with my experiences. I am who I am. No more, but certainly no less either, and that's good. This account comes from the book Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of the Near-Death Experience by Pim Van Lommel, M.D. He's a cardiologist, and this is copyright 2010. Now we continue where we left off in part one, and that's with Moody Stages of NDE. Here are the stages that come from Moody, which are accepted by Van Lommel. Number one, the ineffability of the experience. Ineffability, that means
It's indescribable. A feeling of peace and quiet. All pain is gone. That can be accounted for in the opiate theory. Thirdly, the awareness of being dead, sometimes followed by a noise. This is interesting to me. Sometimes followed by a noise. Because when I felt this, this guy was screaming at me, "You're dead, you're dead," like, "You're dead." The awareness of being dead, sometimes followed by a noise. Yes, I was aware of it, but I didn't believe it. I wasn't dead. I felt fine. The next one, an out-of-body experience. From a position outside and above their bodies, people witness their own resuscitation or operation. I'll give you a link in a minute to a bunch of these short testimonials. The next, a dark space. This is experienced by only 15% of people as frightening. People are pulled toward a small pinpoint of light in this dark space, which they describe as a tunnel experience. They're drawn rapidly toward the light. A frightening NDE. Approximately 1 to 2% of people linger in this dark space and experience their NDE as frightening, also known as a hell experience. Alexander here talks about he was in the experience for so long. He was in a number of different places, but one of the places that was a horror to him was he felt himself in, I would say, a lake of black ooze, as an entity like a tadpole in a lake of black ooze, where he was suspended in this ooze and monstrous creatures would, let's say, swim up to him and look at him as though he were food. And this went on, he said, days at a time, seemed like weeks at a time. He is just suspended as a sensing, a being, sentient being in a sea of black oily ooze. Until on occasion, something would get a hold of him and pull him out of this and bring him up. He felt up to another place where he would meet an angelic-like being, about like no other. But we've heard of these people with hell experiences too. I think a lot of those are going to hell because of their use of trickery on people to get offerings. Yes, I know, I'll take that out. The next, the perception of an unearthly environment, a dazzling landscape with beautiful colors, gorgeous flowers, and sometimes music. I experienced that music one time when I was a late teen. I experienced that. I wrote about it. And all I could say was, I was overwhelmed by all the music in my head. It was a living environment. It was a living thing. It went all around you. And it was marvelous, and it had melodies and harmonies, many, many different ones that you could perceive them all, but you could perceive them all at once. And that is also characteristic of the oneness some people feel with the flow, what we understand now is the flow of life and the absence of time, when they find themselves in the body or out of the body. Only Elohim knows. Meeting and communicating with deceased persons, mostly relatives. The girl told me that she had met with a grandfather, that this grandfather was deceased before her experience. So she'd never met him before, but he was waiting there, and there was for her, and there was a table there that was set up. And they sat at a table and got acquainted. Now, that just came to me. I just remembered that. Meeting with, communicating with deceased persons, mostly relatives. Seeing a brilliant light or being of light. Experiencing complete acceptance and unconditional love and gaining access to a deep knowledge and wisdom. No. One describes the feeling of being not an individual, but being able to reach out in every direction for as far, and to experience everything at once, once he has sorted all out.
Fellow Essenes, it's very difficult for me to break in at this point, but we've run out of time, and we'll have to continue this on the next show. So while you consider near-death experiences and the hope that they bring, perhaps you'll want to treat yourself to a little glass of wine, a piece of cheese, and a morsel of bread, and don't forget to pray.
Which is impossible to do with the brain, because when we have multiple experiences that we're dealing with, what happens there is the rational brain shuts down, as we learned in brain dynamics a few months ago. The rational brain shuts down. It's taught itself to shut down when there's multiple stimuli. But here, that mechanism is not gone because there's no brain there anymore. We're assuming that if there is such a thing as a morphic field in your memories and your relationships are stored there and shared with your ancestors and with your descendants, then there would be no hindrance for your, shall we say, mind or spirit to go forth. There's a panoramic life review. That would be number 9. The entire life flashes before them. There appears to be no time or distance. Everything happens at once, and people can talk for days about a life review that lasted only a few minutes. I've read about these, but never talked to anybody that had one. I'd like to. Number 10, the preview or flash forward. People have the impression that they are witnesses to part of the life that is yet to come. Again, there's no time or distance. 11, the perception of a border. People are aware that if they cross this border or limit, they'll never be able to return to their bodies. And I have read a number of accounts where the person was given a choice. You can come and stay here, or you can go back and take care of what you need to. And there's often almost a feeling of guilt that is explained because there's somebody left behind there. Yet the desire is to stay, but the responsibility is even stronger. And some have been told, you must go back. You must go back. It's not your time. And finally, number 12, which seems to be the greatest traumatic event of the entire sequence, is the conscious return to the body, accompanied by great disappointment or having something so beautiful taken away. Number 12. Those come from 1975, and they haven't changed much since. Now, let me finish up by doing a reading here of just a little bit, a few pages of the introduction to this book, Consciousness Beyond Life. Because in this little section, he explains so much of his intention in the rest of the book. He intends to give us answers. I'm not done, so I just started. So I'm not going to get the answers right now. But I've got a pretty good notion what he's going to say. Here's his reasons for doing his research. On the basis of prospective studies, when empirical scientific studies discover phenomena or facts that are not consistent with current scientific theories, these new facts must not be denied, suppressed, or even ridiculed, as is still quite common. In the event of new findings, the existing theories ought to be elaborated or modified, and if necessary, rejected or replaced. That's a good Essene concept right there. We need new ways of thinking and new forms of science to study consciousness and acquire a better understanding of the effects of consciousness. What he said earlier regarding science is, it's been said that there's nothing so troublesome as a new idea. Tell me about it. Tell me about it. There's nothing as troublesome as a new idea, and I think that's particularly true in, well, he's got science, but I would say theology, or better than that, ecclesiology. Some scientists, such as philosopher David Chalmers, are more receptive and take consciousness seriously. He says, consciousness poses the most baffling problems in the science of the mind. There's nothing that we know more intimately than conscious experience, but there's nothing that's harder to explain. So let's put it off to anomaly. Chalmers specializes in the problem of consciousness and has written an excellent overview of the various theories on the relationship between consciousness and the brain. He promises to explain that later. In the past, new forms of science emerged when prevailing scientific ideas could no longer explain certain phenomena. At the start of the 20th century, for instance, quantum physics emerged because certain findings couldn't be accounted for with classical physics.
This is Commander Lee. We've got to take a break now for some important but feckless platitudes. We'll be right back after you get your daily dose. We're back. I hope you enjoyed the feckless platitudes.
Quantum physics overturned the established view of our material world, that our world may not be a material world, after all. The fact that the new insights provided by quantum physics are being accepted only slowly can be attributed to the materialist worldview with which most of us grew up. Of course, I'm thinking of this in ecclesiastical terms. If we put new doors on the church, they'll start coming in again. According to some quantum physicists, quantum physics accords our consciousness a decisive role in creating and experiencing perceptible reality. There's a theory out now that might not be too far from wrong, that the farther out in space we go, as we look out into space farther, the planets, the suns, the galaxies, and constellations come into being as we perceive them, because they weren't there before. They are created because we perceive them. Think about it. The not yet commonly accepted interpretation posits that our picture of reality is based on the information received by our consciousness. This transforms modern science into a subjective science in which consciousness plays a fundamental role. Let me give you an example. What do you see right now? What do you see? What you see and what your brain in the Wernicke's area, in the visual cortex right back here, interprets for you, it's not even interpreting for that controlling unit in you because there isn't any. There's no controlling body in you. What are you perceiving? Well, it's only the appearance of what's there. It can't possibly be what you're looking at right now on your screen if you're not asleep. That's only an interpretation of something. We don't know what. Had we some other type of optical equipment, it might be completely different. The quantum physicist Werner Heisenberg formulated as follows: science no longer is in the position of observer of nature, but rather recognizes itself as part of the interplay between man and nature. The scientific method changes and transforms its object. The procedure can no longer keep its distance from the object. This is the way it was in Hebrew living that has been driven out of us by materialism and Protestantism in our lives. We don't see the boundaries between the natural and the supernatural, if we can even call them anymore. We don't see the boundaries, and we don't see what's beyond them either. All we see now, because we have been brought up to believe, is the material world. We can seem to have all the faith in the world as long as our material perception remains the same. But when the material perception changes, I would say there would be not one of us that wouldn't panic about our spiritual reality. We haven't been brought up that way. Scientists based in mere materialism, at least my professors when I studied science, they were wholly materialistic. H-W-H-O-L-L-Y, especially in the area of progressive evolution of the species. the experience of certain aspects of consciousness during an NDE are comparable or analogous to concepts from quantum physics. Of course, quantum theory can't explain consciousness, but in conjunction with the results and conclusions from NDE research, it can contribute to a better understanding of the transition or interface between consciousness and the brain. Weren't you taught that it was all in the brain? In my opinion, current science must reconsider its assumptions about the nature of perceptible reality because these ideas have led to the neglect or denial of important areas of consciousness. Current science usually starts from a reality that's based solely on perceptible phenomena. Yet at the same time, we can intuitively sense that besides objective sensory perception, there's a role for subjective aspects such as feelings, inspiration, intuition, revelation. You could probably think of some more. Spirituality, demon oppression. Current scientific techniques can't measure or demonstrate the content of consciousness. It's impossible to produce scientific evidence that somebody is in love or that somebody appreciates a certain piece of music or a particular painting. The things that can be measured are the chemical, electric, or magnetic changes in brain activity. The content of thoughts, feelings, and emotions cannot be measured. If we had no direct experience of our consciousness through our feelings, emotions, and thoughts, we would not be able to perceive it. On the basis of prospective studies of near-death experience, recent results from neurophysiological research, and concepts from quantum physics, I strongly believe, here's a cardiologist, that consciousness cannot be located in a particular time and place. This is a scientific book. Did you hear what he said? Consciousness can't be located in a particular time and place. This is known as non-locality. Complete and endless consciousness is everywhere in a dimension that is not tied to time or place, where past, present, and future all exist and are accessible at the same time. This endless consciousness is always in and around us. We have no theories to prove or measure non-local space and non-local consciousness in the material world. But before I go on, let me remind you that Yahshua said this. He didn't say, the kingdom of God is within you. That is a mistranslation. He said, the kingdom of Elohim is among you. Among you. It makes a world of difference. We go from panentheism to an understanding that is now coming into parallel with scientific thought, at least philosophical scientific thought, to be among the kingdom. All of a sudden, it becomes a shared experience. All of a sudden, consciousness comes together and is loosed from its bonds. Within us, what a totally subjective experience that is. That takes us to places like my Jesus and my God would or my God wouldn't. And you would and you would. But if the kingdom of Elohim is among us, that stretches it out, opens it up, brings us into a different type of unity, but based on equality and the understanding that we are among one another and the kingdom. Non-local consciousness. It almost sounds like we're saying unconsciousness there. Non-local consciousness. The brain and the body merely function as an interface or relay station to receive part of our total consciousness and part of our memories into our waking consciousness. This is a scientist. This is where science is moving. This is unbelievable. Do you get the drift here? Non-local. When they start getting a hold of philosophical ideas like this, then they're going to start using their great minds and facilities to give us the anatomy of spirituality. Like Sheldrake. What did Sheldrake do when he quit materialism and started seeing the idea of morphic fields and resonance? What did he do? He started going in India to the Hindu temple because he was looking for a spiritual place. He didn't know anything about religion. He was an atheist. And he ended up back in the Anglican Church where he grew up. Now, a fervent Anglican churchman and a biologist scientist who is now promoting this idea of non-local consciousness. It's drawn him back. He was never anywhere in the first place. But now he's come at least to an understanding that there is something very, very real about religious faith that he missed completely in his education and upbringing. Our brain may be compared to a television set, receiving information from electromagnetic fields and decoding this into sound and vision. Our consciousness transmits information to the brain, and via the brain receives information from the body and senses. The function of the brain can be compared to a transceiver. Our brain has a facilitating rather than a producing role. It enables the experience of consciousness. There's also increased evidence that consciousness has a direct effect on the function of anatomy of the brain and of the body, with DNA likely to play an important role. What he's not saying here is that our experiences and our stimuli have the ability to actually change the makeup of the DNA strands. It's amazing. Near-death experience prompted the concept of non-local and endless consciousness. Whew. We had faith and visions and dreams and revelations and sky journeys and Enoch and Yahshua descending and ascending. We had all these things before, but what does he say? As a scientist, near-death experience prompts this concept of non-local endless consciousness. And we see in this a failure in his consideration at this point, because this has been going on a long, long time. And over, if you go to JS Presents, underneath this presentation's link is a link to NDEs that were recorded in ancient times, if you're interested in that. I've got a link to a text there that's got a number of great NDEs that were recording long, long before any of us was even thought of. But NDEs and non-local consciousness allow us to understand a wide range of special states of consciousness, like such as mystical and religious experiences, deathbed visions, perimortem, around death. That's Latin, peri, around, death, mort. And postmortem experiences. That's after death experiences. Heightened intuitive feelings or non-local information exchange. Might want to say ESP there. It's an old-fashioned term. Prognostic dreams, remote viewing. Now we're getting into some things we understand. And the mind's influence on matter, which is called non-local perturbation. Ultimately, we can't avoid the conclusion that endless consciousness has always been and always will be independently of the body. There's no beginning and there will never be an end to our consciousness. For this reason, we ought to seriously consider the possibility that death, like birth, may be a mere passing from one state of consciousness into another, and that during life the body functions as an interface or place of, yeah, that's right, Bob, resonance. Oh, listen, this is liberating stuff. Honest to goodness, I am a materialist. I wasn't when I was young. Not at all. I was looking for mysticism, visions, and revelations. I expected that. I went into the church thinking I could teach the church spirituality, show the church how to have visions and revelations, show the church how to experience the spiritual gifts. Well, he goes on about that, Bob, but you don't want to hear another 3.5 pages. Well, he talks about the book. What happens with the judgment? You ought to ask that question. The judgment, we read in religious terms in the scripture. And what it tells us is that every person that ever lived is going to face a judgment of works. It doesn't make any difference whether a person is religious or not or knows anything about this. One of the characteristics that is common among these people that go a long way into this and then come back is that they face such a judgment, that they see in detail everything they ever did, and that minutes go by for what seem like days and days while this judgment goes on and flashes before them, and there's somebody there that's a judge and that questions them afterwards or during. Many NDAs I've read that while the investigative judgment goes on here for the person, the perceived other in the room is asking questions. Do you remember this? What did you get from this? What did you do here? Judgment. There's also the promise in Scripture that everybody, and perhaps everybody not only that ever lived, but maybe ever had the opportunity to eventually live, will live again. Will live again. What form that takes? Well, the Scripture really doesn't talk about going up to heaven that much as it does, like the creed, the resurrection of the dead. If consciousness never ends, the point of the resurrection of the dead is that the consciousness will come back into a body useful for this atmosphere. We need, if we're going to do things among people, we're going to need the facilities or the tools to do things in this world. But we have these bodies. They're good for this kind of work. They hold up for a while. We could go a lot farther if we got bodies, our bodies back, like Eben Alexander got his cerebral cortex back. No, religion is what you do with your spirituality. You are spiritually of no value unless your religion includes orphans, widows, and staying unspotted of the world. This is part of this judgment. The Bible never says you get in anywhere by grace, except Paul a couple of times, and he contradicts himself. He shouldn't even be in there. Since when is judged people, are people judged just because somebody likes them or because they say it a sinner's prayer? When these people have their NDEs, their lives change. What their interests were before are converted to something far more useful to humankind. And some plain old blackguards have been changed into loving, caring individuals that have given their lives, the rest of their lives, to some cause of human suffering or endeavor to make up for the way they lived before they had the NDE. Well, how many sections are you allowed to keep? I think if I could keep one section, I'll keep the Epistle of James. That's the one I want, because that's what I aspire to. And I would say I never got to that judgment thing in an NDE, but you know, there's a good chance that I may sometime. I want to be able... Why? Why would I even want to be able to? Why wouldn't I want to glory in sin? Been hearing a lot on YouTube about sociopaths lately, psychopaths. I listen to this stuff all night long. You never know what's going to be on when you wake up. Yeah, glory in my sins. But a lot of people think that way. But even if they do, once they go through this tunnel and come back, their minds are changed. All right, maybe we'll go on with this later. I'm going to try to get this young lady one more time. But this book, it's big and it's good, and it goes into every aspect you can think of in trying. Why? I'm not even sure why it's called near-death experience, because this is an integrative approach of materialism and spiritualism. This is what we need right now. This is what the Essenes went for. This is why their books were banned. This is why when the Pharisees took over the government of Israel and the religious system with their Sadducees, all these sacred books were cast out. This is why the Pharisees and Sadducees would not allow anyone to read Ezekiel or Genesis chapter 6. You say she talks to the dead? Well, that's something that we probably don't want to do. talk to the dead. That's necromancy. And it is strictly forbidden as a mortal sin in Deuteronomy 18. And besides, once you get a psychic friend, you don't get rid of them very easy. Anyway, anything, anybody have a NDE they want to share?
No.
You do?
No, I have a comment.
Well, come up here.
Question.
Come up here to the sagging chair. Come on.
Should we strive or try to experience these experiences without trying to kill ourselves, of course, but should we try to emulate these experiences without harmful drugs or actually trying to kill ourselves in order to further the walk? That's my question.
Well, from a scientific viewpoint, there was a book came out in 1969 called The Natural Mind. My girlfriend gave me a copy of this book. And in that book, I read it with a lot of care because at that time, everyone was experimenting with drugs. Mm-hmm. And the scientist or philosopher that wrote it, I can't remember who, it's still on the market though. It's a good book. Said that the mind, wherever that was located, has a natural propensity, being confined to the flesh, to get out of it.
Ah, okay. Might have been Abby Hoffman, probably.
Well, it was somebody like that. But the book was called The Natural Mind. He didn't advocate using substances.
No.
But he said, this is why. Because people no longer understand ancient spirituality. We're living in times that don't require spirituality, that have been taken over by materialism. And he made a good case for that. But I wouldn't feel good trying to have a religious experience while being high on something. I just would seem foreign to me, but that's me. Mm-hmm. I'm a materialist.
Valerie has a comment here.
Go ahead.
We cannot induce. It is up to him. We won't even know till it happens. If one says they can make it happen, red flag, please. I was reading about the Kabbalists, and they were saying that the state of prophecy that the old prophets were getting into were realized with natural means, as far as worship and prayer and meditation. Once people found out that they can induce that prophetic state with drugs, that's when a lot of they call it idolatry and different witchcraft came into the in a sense, Judaism, I'll call it that. So they were advocating going through the discipline of the steps to reaching that prophetic state. And it's lighting up. And fasting. Ah, yes. I imagine.
What's the difference between fasting and drugs? Artificial means.
A fasting does reach, put that, because it's depriving the body of its, in a sense, Kabbalism is so, but depriving is an emptying of yourself. So what better way to empty your self than to not eat? And it also puts you into a state of cleansing and spirituality. The prophets all fasted. Yahshua fasted.
Sensory deprivation.
Definitely. Yeah. Ezekiel.
We were talking about that just a minute ago.
Yes, we were.
Sensory deprivation. He lays on one side 186 days.
Your self can fall away, and the spirit of Yahweh can come in and reveal things to you.
Thank you. Yeah, very good. Think of those people that induce these things by stressing their body. You know them? I know them. They run 5 miles as fast as they can up the side of a bridge and down. On the way down, they're feeling pretty good because they're opiating themselves. They're opiating. What's the difference between that and shooting up heroin? I'm just playing the devil's advocate here. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. How is sensory deprivation, like Ezekiel laying on his side and eating bread that was almost made out of manure for all those days? Or who else are we talking about that deprived themselves terribly? Look at Job. I'm sure that he had visions and revelations around the campfire with the other guys that he had there. Well, these are questions that we may be dealing with over here. And Valerie, I wish... Well, that brings up something. What about non-local consciousness? Is there gender? Morphic fields. The border of the field. We ought to have that word he, she, definitely. Or she, he. That's the border. We're just learning about these things. But they fall right in especially if we, as we did one time here, we read Ephesians chapter 2 in Greek. We took it out of the Greek. The wording was such that it would fall right in with this study. I tell you, Paul was a genius, but he was a troubled man for troubled times. Oh, it's not respectful. Okay. Tia's here tonight. I didn't know, Tia, that you came to such low-class venues, but I'm glad that you are here. What's been happening with the Jesus Family 2? Anything new you can share? Anything new from Simca or James? Same old, same old. Okay, you haven't figured out the tomb logo, chevrons. Boy, that's an interesting subject.
Once again, my friends, time has passed us by, and we have to quit for the day. But let me give you one fact. You are always in our thoughts and prayers. Your emails and phone calls are mighty welcome, and we have appreciated to no end all the recommendations we've been getting from you, and also the help in the form of links and manuscripts. Now, this is Jackson Snyder at the Vero Yehad North with a glass of cold Clamato juice in my hand, signing off.